Welcome to A Conversation with History. I'm Harry Kreisler of the Institute of International Studies. Our guest today is the Right Honorable Lord Patten of Barnes. Lord Patten is the Chancellor of Oxford University. His distinguished career includes serving the United Kingdom as Secretary of State for the Environment, Member of Parliament from Bath, Chairman of the Conservative Party, Governor General of Hong Kong, Chairman of the Independent Commission on Policing for Northern Ireland, and most recently, Commissioner for External Affairs of the European Union. His new book is Cousins and Strangers, America, Britain, and Europe in a New Century. Lord Patten, welcome to Berkeley.
Nice to be here again.
What were your responsibilities as Commissioner for External Affairs of the European Union?
I had the job of coordinating all those aspects of Commission policy, all those things where the member states have already given competence to the centre. I had the responsibility of coordinating all of those and principally of running our development programmes and our political cooperation programmes. I played a role in trade, in bilateral relations with countries from China to Chile, and I guess spent most of my time dealing with neighborhood issues, dealing with the Balkans, our Mediterranean partners, Russia, the Southern Caucasus countries, and so on.
So how did your previous portfolios prepare you for this job?
Well, I'd known already quite a lot about development issues because I had been Britain's development minister in the 1980s for 3 years. I guess it's also fair to say that as governor of Hong Kong, I'd been involved at the sharp end of foreign policy. I think it's fair to say, without being, without bragging, that I doubt whether anybody in British politics has had so much experience of dealing with international affairs, development, Asia, the last colonial oppressor, the last colonial governor. So I had a lot of dealings with China and the European Commission.
Should we be surprised that a British Conservative, you were head of your party, should undertake this job?
No, because I belonged to the mainstream of the Conservative Party, which had always been pro-European. For all my political youth, for all my political apprenticeship, and for my years as an MP and in office, the Conservative Party was the pro-European party in British politics. It was, on the whole, the Labour Party which had difficulty reconciling its aspirations with Britain's membership of the EU, and particularly reconciling rather traditional views about British sovereignty with membership of the EU. Until 92, when I left British politics, or direct interest in British politics, that remained the case. And then during the process of ratifying in Parliament the Maastricht Treaty, which John Major had negotiated very successfully, and partly as a result of Britain's exit from the European exchange rate mechanism, the chemistry of British politics changed considerably, and the Conservative Party was torn apart by Europe. Winston Churchill once said that the problem about committing political suicide is that you live to regret it. And that is certainly what happened with the Conservative Party, I think.
Mm-hmm. And do you see, just to do an aside here, do you think the party correcting the error of its ways over time?
I think what it's started to do under a new leader is to correct at least part of what has gone wrong. Many people in the Conservative Party, as Mr. Blair has moved to the right, or moved his government, though probably not the Labour Party, to the right, because it's popular and sensible to do so. Many Conservatives thought that Conservatives themselves should move to the right in order to leave a space between themselves and Labour. What it meant was that we moved off the middle ground where you win and lose elections onto more extreme ground, And detached ourselves from the common sense majority in British politics. Now, David Cameron, the new young leader of the Conservative Party, to his credit, is trying to re-establish the Conservative Party as a moderate party. He hasn't got round to Europe yet, and I think he will have more difficulty with that, both because he doesn't know very much about the subject and because there's been a sort of Pavlovian reaction in the Conservative Party for the last few years against anything European. It bears no relationship to what we would be obliged to do in office, but I think it will take Cameron rather longer to deal with that.
This is your third visit to our program, and one of the things that emerged very clearly in those programs and in your career is your concern about ideas as you engage in politics. And I would like for you to explain for our American audience what you think the key idea at the heart of the European Union is that makes someone like you become a part of that process.
I think that there are three points I would put. First of all, the historic reason for the European Union, which was very much advocated not just by Monnet and Schuman, but by Americans after the Second World War, was that we should turn our back on 19th century nationalism and through economic and political integration make the sort of European civil wars of the past a thing of history. And at the heart of the European Union has been the reconciliation of France and Germany, very different from what's happened in Asia, where there hasn't been a reconciliation between China and Japan, with those two countries lashed together at the heart of the enterprise. Now, it has involved sovereignty sharing to a unique extent, but sovereignty sharing between nation states. It's nation states that provide the political leadership and the democratic accountability. That is the reason for the European Union being founded in the first place. Talking about it today, people tend to overlook that very important trigger which fired the European Union into space in the first place. But there are two other reasons which I would adduce, which I think are enormously important ideas which Europe represents today. First of all, we live in a world in which nation states can't any longer deal with the threats which come at them from all sides or provide people with the opportunities that they want and need. And even though people feel their natural loyalty and affinity to nation states, the largest entity, I think, to which they can feel loyalty, they nevertheless recognize that states need to work together to an unparalleled extent in order to deal with issues from environmental disaster to epidemic disease and so on. And Europe, 25 member states, virtually the whole of Europe, joined together, trying to do a lot of things jointly and earning in partnership the sort of strength which none of us would have on our own. If you look, for example, at the moment about energy policy in Europe, we're far better off at dealing with Russia or dealing with the Middle East or dealing with West Africa, all of them rather difficult areas. We're far better off working together to deal with the subject of future energy need than if we work separately. The third reason, I'm sorry to speak at such length, the third reason is that Europe's most successful foreign policy has been enlargement, has been offering membership of the European Union to our neighbours, Spain, Portugal, Greece, when they escaped from fascist authoritarianism in the late 1970s, early 80s. Most recently, the former countries of the Soviet Empire, from the Baltic to the Black Sea. And I think that is something which a process which we still haven't completed. And for me, one of the arguments about keeping our commitments to Turkey, provided Turkey continues on the process of in the process of economic and political reform, is that it does mean, first of all, demonstrating that the European Union is a way of reconciling not just different minorities, but different ethnic and religious groups. Secondly, I think it gives a real bridge between the Western world and the Islamic world, albeit in Turkey's case, it's a secular Islamic state. So I would say that to the historic reason, ending wars in Europe, we can add today the practical point that countries have to work together, and the future point that I think this is one of the best ways of finding an accommodation between traditional Western societies and Islam.
And enlargement is really an important process, because in a way it is Europe's way of bringing democratization and marketization to at least near countries or countries that are considered historically part of Europe.
Absolutely. I think sometimes in America, people, even policymakers, confuse the European Union with an alliance. Mm-hmm. It's much more than that, where you agree to share sovereignty, for example, in order to create a real market. One of the things you're doing is accepting the legislative and judicial authority that's required in order to make Europe-wide regulation work. Within that European Union, we've agreed to share decision-making to an extraordinary degree, but leaving aside some of those areas which still help to define a modern nation state, like tax-raising powers. So it's an interesting model of international governance, nothing like it being tried before. I suspect that in the future we'll see copies in other parts of the world, like Southeast Asia and Latin America.
In your previous book, after your experience in Hong Kong, you emphasized very much the link between political values and economic values, between political liberty and economic liberty. And it sounds to me like democratization moves that process along as part of a negotiating process.
Yes, I think we've been, to return to your question, I think we've been extremely successful at regime change without using tanks or the military. We've used the offer of membership of the European Union to promote political and economic reform. And it's very interesting to see how that is now working in the Balkans. It worked very well in Central and Eastern Europe, where the change from Soviet imperialism, from Russian imperialism, was managed democratically and without any violence or mayhem. That wasn't true with the dismemberment of Yugoslavia, which was, I think, the most humiliating time for Europe, as we stood by arguing among ourselves while Yugoslavia went up in flames. Now, in the last few years, trying to recover what has been lost, or some of what's been lost, we've offered members of the Balkan community the prospect of membership of the European Union. So they have to conduct economic and political reforms, and if they do so, they then qualify to start negotiating for membership of the Union. Croatia has achieved that already. Macedonia is in the process of achieving it. And I hope that others, Serbia, Montenegro, Albania, Bosnia-Herzegovina, will come along in due course, though it's going to take some time. But the magnet which encourages them to change is membership of the European Union. And if we were to take that away, I'm not sure what our policy would be other than the stationing of troops.
Mm-hmm. You quote Churchill from a 1948 speech where he says, this process must be viewed as the gradual assumption by all nations concerned of the larger sovereignty, which alone can protect their diverse and distinctive customs and the characteristics of their national tradition. So that's the other side of this that you have to deal with. That is, in as they participate in this process of union and enlargement, that they feel that their identities and their histories and traditions are not threatened. That is, the people you're bringing on board.
Yes, I think it's the most difficult aspect of the whole enterprise, and it's the one which causes most problem in my own country, where there is a rather ludicrous fear that we are creating in Europe a super state, or the country Europe, to use a phrase much used on the right in British politics. It's simply not true. No national member of the European Union has seen its nationhood diluted. The Poles are as Polish as ever. The French, look at President Chirac, pass him, are as French as ever. We're as British as ever. But we have agreed, in order to protect de facto sovereignty, to sacrifice some de jure sovereignty. In Britain, we have a problem sometimes distinguishing between those things. But to give you an example of what it means, Norway has chosen to stay outside the European Union. Nevertheless, the European Union is its biggest market, and in order to sell into the European Union, it has to follow our rules and regulations. So Norwegian ministers have all the additional sovereignty which goes with not coming to Brussels to make the decisions, which they then actually implement more rapidly than any EU member state. It's an absurdity. There is, I think, a serious problem here, and in my judgment, it's the most interesting in political science. As I said earlier, people feel their natural loyalty and attachment to the institutions of nation states, even while knowing that nation states can't protect them in the way they used to. So we have to cooperate, and we establish institutions to manage the shared sovereignty. But people don't feel the same enthusiasm for the institutions that manage the shared sovereignty as they do for their national parliaments or civil services or judicial systems. And that, I think, does create a real problem about accountability. There is no European electorate. There is no pan-European demos. There are electorates in individual countries. But there isn't a European electorate which provides that sense of accountability, which people understandably look for.
Mm-hmm. And I know that in your career, you were a member of Parliament, and as Governor General of Hong Kong, you put your ear to the ground to understand what was happening. It seems that the Commission and other parts of the organization of the European Union have failed in winning popular support if we look at the recent votes on the Constitution. What is the problem here? Is it that the institutions for hearing what the people's concerns are not adequately developed, or that local politicians manipulate sentiment? What is the issue?
It's certainly true that local politicians like to blame the European institutions, which they themselves have created, whenever anything goes wrong, whether it's the fault of the European institutions or not. And most of the problems we face in Europe are, like low economic growth in some countries, are the fault of national governments, not anything at the European level. But I think there are another couple of reasons which explain the unpopularity of parts of the European project. First of all, there is a disconnect between European rhetoric and what we are actually trying to do. There are still people who talk rather wisperly, rather vacuously about ever greater European integration. That's for the birds. I think that integration has gone about as far as the market will bear, and that the name of the game now is doing what we've already agreed to do together more competently. As a British politician, I didn't fight every election with people saying to me, OK, now give us the vision for the next stage in the creation of the United Kingdom. Mm-hmm. What people wanted was assurance that one would manage the country's affairs competently and keep the peace. And I think we should stop hunting for new ways of launching integration projects and recognize that the main task of the European institutions for the time being is to run things effectively and competently. There is, second, a European Parliament, which does a big job and in many ways an important job, but it's a virtual parliament. And it's divorced from national politics. People don't know who their European parliamentarians are, by and large. And their European parliamentarians, in large measure, can't wait for the opportunity of trying to become national rather than European politicians. It debates in virtual languages, and you never really can follow a debate very easily through interpreters. So I think that this problem of linking decision-making with electorates is a real cause of confusion in the European Union, and it's one of the reasons why, as I said, I think that the process of integration has gone about as far as it could.
Let's take a problem that the EU confronts that transcends both foreign policy and domestic policy. And what I have in mind here, the West's relationship with the Muslim world, really. Because on the one hand, it's a problem for Europe of dealing with states, of dealing with that whole region of instability. But on the other hand, it's a problem of dealing with Muslim immigrants to the different states,
sure,
and having to defer to what are essentially the national policies for successfully or not successfully or unsuccessfully integrating Muslims. Talk a little about that. I mean, these two processes are obviously separate, but is there a way that we can think about them as one and learn from the two experiences?
Well, I think it's quite difficult to persuade Muslim communities within European countries that they are not an alien part of our societies, but an integral part. If they feel that there is an inherent hostility towards the Islamic community outside the European Union, it's why I said earlier, I think the question of Turkish membership is such an important one in the future. We do need to remember in the European Union that linkage, just as we need to remember that when we talk about the Islamic world, we're not just talking about the Middle East, but three-quarters of Muslims live in Asia, and many of them in working, functioning democracies. So I think we have to avoid typecasting Muslims, assuming that there is some inherent hostility between Islamic culture and democracy and the rule of law and human rights, for example. There are different models, as you said, for dealing with minority communities in the European Union. The French take a very different approach to the one we take in Britain. The French view is that when you arrive in France, whatever your background, you're a French citizen, and you have to behave like a French citizen. We take a rather more nuanced view and think that there is strength in diversity, and one, of course, recognizes people's responsibilities as British citizens, but they're British citizens with their own sense of loyalty and to their culture and to their traditions. Which is the right approach? I just say two things. First of all, I don't think that you can read very much from the riots in France in November, which seemed to me to be as much about unemployment as about attitudes to culture. Secondly, what should be true of all of us in Europe is that we should insist that whatever people's religious views or cultural background, they recognize that it's tolerance that has managed to hold our communities together. And I think that the one thing we should be absolutely adamant about is not allowing some to argue that intolerance is an inherent part of their culture and tradition, and that they can practice it in our own communities. That, I think, is simply unacceptable.
Europe and the U.S. and the world face a number of challenges, and I'm curious as to what you feel in during your tenure was your greatest achievement or achievements in moving forward on, you know, a number of the challenges that you talk about in your book, the problem of demographic changes in Europe. Well, that wouldn't have been on your portfolio, but the problems of globalization, the problem of global warming, the problem of looking at terrorism in light of the underlying conditions that produce the terrorists.
I think that the biggest achievements during my period were in keeping our policy in the Balkans on the road and developing a more sympathetic policy towards our neighbours. But if I look at some of the other problems that you mentioned, I couldn't hand on heart argue that we had been very successful, though maybe it was sufficient to protect the Kyoto Protocol, to protect the International Criminal Court from the assault of the U.S. administration. My period as a commissioner coincided with an extraordinary change in American attitudes to global leadership and to foreign policy. I'd grown up in a world created in large part by that post-war generation of American political leaders, the Draper from Missouri, Harry Truman, Marshall, Acheson, and others, a world which established rules that we all had to play by, the UN, the Bretton Woods institutions, and so on. And it was a world which suited the United States extremely well, and it suited the rest of us extremely well, too. And it was surprising, therefore, to find oneself dealing with an administration which appeared to want to throw over all that. I've argued in my book that, in my judgment, as soon as you see the word neo, you know that it really means non. So neo-intellectuals don't read books, and neo-liberals are very, very rarely liberal. Neo-conservatives are certainly not conservative, because the conservative thing for an American administration to do is to preserve an order which has worked for the U.S., worked for the rest of us, and not only legitimized American power, but protected America from the world's envy. And I very much hope that at a high cost, partly a cost paid in the thankless deserts of Mesopotamia, as Churchill once called them, I very much hope that the United States, this administration maybe, certainly future ones, will return to a more sensible and generous-spirited approach to global leadership. And we should do all we can in Europe by recognizing that we're partners, not rivals of America, to encourage that moment when it happens.
Mm-hmm. We should tell our audience that you are a man whose whole career is one that demonstrates very great affection for the United States, going back to your younger days when your father was someone who brought American music.
Yeah, I only came into politics because of America. I was over here as a student and got involved in an American campaign in New York in 1965, which shows how old I am. I've visited America with huge regularity. Many of my heroes are American. Many of my many of my cultural reference points are American. Many of my best friends are ditto. And it comes as rather a shock to find oneself saying things which are very critical of US policy. They're not critical, I don't think, of America. They're critical of a particular political caste in America. A few years ago, when talking about the Balkans, Secretary Baker, James Baker, said that we don't have a dog in that fight. But when we see in America the debate between the assertive nationalists, the neocons, and the more traditional views on foreign policy, we know that we do have a dog in that fight.
And I'm curious, you're a man who studies history, or you're a man who studied politics. How do you account for this drastic change? What is your gut feeling about the factors that have led us astray?
I think that it's partly a consequence of a sense that the world is Hobbesian and brutish, and that the only way of coping with it is by pulling the gates closed, occasionally foraying out in the world to beat up opponents or potential opponents, regarding the world as a sort of barbaric Darwinian battlefield. And that view, I think, is reflected in the notion of the sovereigntist, that anything which undermines America's ability to do whatever it wants at any particular moment must be against the US's US administration's best interest. In other words, you can't depend on partners, you can't work through the UN without undermining America's God-given right to do whatever it wants. I think that point of view was probably given, unfortunately, tragically, some greater credibility by 9/11, which brought home in a terrible way the understanding that America might be invincible but was not invulnerable. Now, I don't think that what has happened since 9/11 bears out that sovereigntist argument. Indeed, I think that since 9/11, the policies pursued by the administration have made the world today and the world in which my children and grandchildren will grow up a more dangerous place. What's the answer? The answer, I think, is to return to a more traditional idea of working through partnership. And it's terribly important for those of us who have historically been partners of the United States to show that we can make those partnerships work, that we're not simply copping out of the difficulties. Because while it still is true that if you want something difficult done, you have to turn to the United States, it's also true that a lot of the things that America wants to do are easier to do if it can work with Europe.
Mm-hmm. One would have to suggest that another possibility here is hope that a balancer will emerge in the international system to balance American power, in addition to what you are suggesting. Do you see that happening in the midterm or in the long term?
Not entirely in the terms in which you suggest. I think that it's been traditional to associate centuries with countries, and provided you're not French, a lot of people would regard the 19th century as being Britain's century. They'd regard the 20th century as being America's, and they would say today that the 21st century is going to see a struggle between America and China for preeminence. I don't actually entirely buy that. I don't think China will, for the foreseeable future, I don't think it will ever be as great a military power as the United States. It's going to be the largest economy in the world this century, just as it's been for 18 out of the last 20 centuries. And that's partly a result of the size of China, but it won't be as rich as America or Europe. It'll get old before it gets rich, and its per capita wealth will never be the same as ours. Nevertheless, while not seeing China as a threat, while not seeing the future as being a struggle between China and America, what I do think is true is that America and Europe have to realize that almost any problem we want to solve, we will require to work, it will be required of us that we work with India and China. Whether you're looking at nuclear proliferation, environmental hazard, epidemic disease, increasing global trade, whatever the issue, we need actually to work with China and India. And that doesn't just mean telling them what to do. It means actually involving them much more in global leadership. I'll give you one example of, in those circumstances, what I think is crazy. We're all going to be affected by China and India's, but by China's energy requirements in the next few years. We're all going to be affected if China allows those energy requirements to so shape its political tactics and strategy as to make it difficult, for example, for the Security Council to deal with Sudan and Darfur. Mm-hmm. We have to be able to persuade the Chinese that failed and failing states are as much a problem for them as they are for us. How do you persuade the Chinese of those things? You treat them like serious citizens, and you try to involve them in serious issues of the management of global resources. And in those circumstances, what on earth sense does it make to block the takeover of Unocal by a Chinese oil company? We should be bringing them into the game, not trying to shut them out of it.
Mm-hmm. Is it the problem that we can never decide whether we're in the new world of globalization, where we're all partners, or that old world, that Hobbesian world of anarchy and international, some zero competition?
Well, it was America, more than anyone else, who taught us to turn our back on the 19th century. I think you can perfectly properly see Woodrow Wilson's 14 points, not only as his response to Leninism, but his response to the way in which the European countries and others had been dominated by a Hobbesian view of international politics. It would, as I say, be ironic if it was, now that we've learnt that lesson from the United States, if the United States was to turn away from it. And I think it would be, a tragedy if that happened. Even though the U.S. is the biggest, toughest, strongest, culturally as well as militarily, country in the world, even if we still to a degree live in the Pax Americana, even despite all that, every problem that America faces, it requires partners in order to deal with it.
One piece of this puzzle about Europe's role in educating America, not balancing, you're not saying balancing, but convincing America that partnership is important, is its capacity to develop a common foreign and defense policy. Has there been progress in that regard? Does more need to be done?
Yes, more needs to be done. You recognize that we're not trying to create a single foreign policy. Mm-hmm. We talk about a single currency, but nobody's talking about a single foreign policy. There isn't going to be one foreign ministry and one foreign minister in Europe. But we should be able to do more in common. And here I come to a point which it's perhaps undiplomatic to say, if some of those who are listening to you are Spanish or Italian or Portuguese or Polish or Danish or whatever. There isn't a European common position on a big issue internationally unless France and Germany and Britain agree. We haven't been lucky in the last few years in having Chancellor Schroeder, President Chirac, and even, though I'll explain why I say this, Mr. Blair in the driving seat. Chancellor Schroeder is now no longer with us. He's now in Mr. Putin's employ, running a company which I think has slightly dodgy antecedents when you look at the at some of those involved in it, but there it is. Money matters more to some people than to others. President Chirac will, God willing, return to the Corrèze next year, thanks to the electorate. Mr. Blair could have played a really important role in shaping a sensible partnership role for Europe with the United States, could have played an important leadership role, had it not been for the fact, I'm afraid, that by embracing the Iraq venture so enthusiastically, he destroyed a lot of his credibility in the rest of Europe. And that's been his tragedy, and in a way, our tragedy as well. So now we must put a lot of faith in Angela Merkel. She's not a German Margaret Thatcher. It's unfair to both of them to suggest that. But she's a very canny politician who I think has Helmut Kohl's ability to distinguish between what's important and what isn't important, and Chancellor Kohl's ability to work for sensible and practical compromises. And if I was an American foreign policy official, I would work very hard to get alongside Chancellor Merkel.
So the problem of forging this common policy, is that a problem for the Commission or a problem for the leaders in their meetings?
It's a problem for the nation states. It's a problem for the national leaders, the leaders of big countries. It's interesting, it's part of the phenomenon of doing business in Europe, that the most successful presidencies of the European Union are nearly always small countries, who don't bring a great bagload of prejudices and positions with them, but simply want to conduct business efficiently.
Mm-hmm. Let me step back a minute and look at the landscape, drawing on your experience in all these different positions. Is foreign policy harder to do than domestic politics, and if so, why?
I think prime ministers, heads of government, after a while, find it easier. Partly because they confuse foreign policy with being nice to foreigners. But I think that it's every bit as difficult as domestic policy if you take a cerebral approach to it. The trouble is that too often foreign policy can turn into a sort of intellect-free zone, and people will simply react from meeting to meeting rather than having a consistent line of policy which they develop. A lot of leaders of governments delude themselves that they can somehow persuade their opposite number to redefine his or her idea of the national interest of that country through charm and diplomatic pizzazz, and it's simply not true. So I think that foreign policy deserves more critical intellectual attention than it gets, but it becomes for a lot of heads of government a resort to which they can return again and again when the opinion polls on domestic policy are looking awkward.
What about personality in politics? How important is the individual leader in making a difference? It obviously made a difference that for Britain that Tony Blair was prime minister at the time of the Iraq War. It obviously made a difference, it seems, that President Bush was in power after 9/11.
I think that what George Bernard Shaw, a G and a B, but not the Shaw, called the Cleopatra's nose of history, still has a great deal to be said for it. I think people do make a difference. I think it would have made a difference if President Chirac hadn't been president of France, if President Bush hadn't been president of the United States. It would plainly have been a different America if Senator Gore had won in 2000. I don't say whether it would have been better or not, though I have my own views on that, but it would certainly have been different. So I think people do make a difference, and sometimes that is for the better and sometimes it's for the worse.
In your last chapter, you take us back to the Peloponnesian War, and you talk about the Athenian articulation of its policies and beliefs to the people of Melos before that place was defeated. And in summary, that the strong do what they have the power to do, and the weak accept what they have to accept. What can transform that equation? I mean, do we have to wait for power to balance power, or can the power of ideas and of advocacy do something about the inequality of power?
It was part of America's wisdom. It was an essential part of America's soft power that for years it understood that it couldn't behave as though it could simply throw its weight around, get its own way, and if people didn't like it, tough luck. I was drawn to the analogy with the Peloponnesian wars for all sorts of reasons, not least the fact that since I was a 14 or 15 year old, I've been reading Thucydides, first of all as a classic student at school, and more recently because of the lessons I think one learns. The Peloponnesian Wars, you may remember, destroyed Athens and Athenian power. And during the course of those wars, fought unnecessarily and with extravagant expectations of protecting Athenian maritime trade, during the course of those wars, the Athenians, for example, ganged up on smaller states like Melos, went to Melos and said, Thucydides has a wonderful account of this, said, get real. I mean, you guys are small. You've got to leave Sparta, leave the Spartan League and join us. And the Melians, to their credit, though it led to disaster, said, no, we're not going to do that. And the Athenians pillaged and sacked Melos and then lost the war. And one of the reasons why they lost the war, which is implied, indeed more than that, explicitly stated in Thucydides, is because of the abuse of power. Because they forgot what Pericles said in his spectacular funeral oration, which is in every book of great speeches, at the beginning of the war, that Athens had been an education to the whole of Greece. Well, throughout my lifetime, America has been an education to the world. It's represented the values which the rest of the world aspires to. It's been the country which most other people around the world want to get a green ticket to live in, or an awful lot of them. And it would be very sad if we saw that weapon of mass attraction abandoned, because I think it's been a terribly important protection for America against the world's anger and jealousy and dread.
One final question, Lord Patton. If students were to watch this program, how would you advise them to prepare for the future?
I would say to them something which people often think is pathetic and doesn't reflect the real world. I would say that they can make a difference to the world they live in, and that it is a terrible surrender not to try to make that world better. After all, it's made worse by people through acts of commission and omission. So why not try to make it better, both by the sort of profession that you choose, by the interest you take in the world around you, by your commitment to voluntary action, as well as to action through your own profession. I'd also say, which is related to that, that, and it's a point I sometimes make at school prize givings, not always making me popular with head teachers, I think the world has been made better by people who are difficult customers, by people who make a fuss. I think we need some rather more awkward customers rather than smooth and successful financial service employees.
On that note, Lord Patton, I want to, before I thank you for your visit, I want to show your book, which I recommend very highly, called Cousins and Strangers, America, Britain, and Europe in a New Century. But I want to thank you very much for making this your third appearance on our program. Thank you very much for
being here. I hope I survive to do a fourth.
Good. Thank you. And thank you very much for joining us for this conversation with history. Thank you.